been going through some sections of the book of Revelation. I have another one today. We'll do one more next week, and then we'll kind of end this discussion we've had. I've tried very hard to pull out of Revelation things that are sort of universal or eternal. I believe a lot of the book of Revelation was written for people in the first century to understand the events that were going on. And I tend to see that a lot of the things that are in there are just sort of things that kind of crop up in every generation. We have evil that we have to confront. We have evil rulers we have to deal with. There's all kinds of things in there that I think keep coming up that are relevant for us even today. Today's lesson is kind of no different than that. I'm trying to look at some of the universal things in there that are relevant to every day and age. As we look at what we're going to talk about today, we remember that the saints are called to endure. It's one of the things that constantly comes up in the book of Revelation. We're called to endure. We're called to conquer. And we have to do that in the midst of what essentially appears to be a war in the spiritual realms. God confronts and conquers the forces of evil in the spiritual realm. But it affects us. We're involved directly in the battle. And the images that we see in the book of Revelation remind us what we're up against. And the battle reminds us that we need God's power. We can't do it with the power of our own. And we can't ignore the battle that's going on, which is probably what a lot of people do. They basically deny the narrative here. They deny that there, in fact, is a spiritual battle going on. But we believe better. We believe different. We know better. And so as we look at the book of Revelation today in some sections, I want to, first of all, get us to think about just who the enemy is. I began to mention last week, I kind of bring it up today and give it a little bit more detail. The enemy is described in several ways. Number one, he's described as a serpent or a dragon. He's described as beasts and described also as the great prostitute. Pretty stark images of the kind of things that we are battling. In chapter 12, verses 9 and verse 17, the serpent or dragon is clearly, we're told that that is Satan. Very similar to what we saw back in the Genesis chapter 3 when man was first tempted. And it is he who fights against the saints. Ultimately, in chapter 21 and verse 10, he is thrown into a bottomless pit and finally into the lake of fire. Seems only a fitting end knowing the destruction that he's caused, but it's still very dramatic and still a very powerful image that we have to face. In chapter 13, the beasts are described, and there's more than one. The first, we are told, in verse 5 of chapter 13, utters blasphemies against God. He sets himself up as something that is to be worshipped. And in chapter 13 and verse 12, the second beast, as he is described, calls for people to worship the first beast. And it's that second beast that often kind of gets us intrigued, because that second beast is given a number, and that number is 666. We believe that one of the interpretations that could very clearly be imposed upon that is probably referring to Nero, one of the emperors of the first century, who was one of the first actually to officially and forthrightly begin persecution of the saints. He put many of them to death around Rome itself, and so it's very possible that that's a reference to Nero. And you may or may not be aware that over the centuries, the beast 666 has been applied to any number of different people. Okay? And there's all kinds of ways people have used. I believe even Ronald Wilson Reagan, each of his names has six letters, so 666, you know, the Pope. In the Reformation, the Pope was considered to be the beast, 666, and there's any number of different ways that people have tried to use that. I believe it's a metaphor for the evil people. And there may be one individual at some point. There's some indication in the book of Thessalonians that there seems to be one particular individual. I can't say I know who that's going to be or what that's all about. What I can tell you is that 1 John chapter 4 and verse 3 says the Antichrist is already present in the world. And that was in the first century. And he says in another place, there are many antichrists, people who deny Jesus Christ. Okay. And so what we have here is evil being described. Whether it's one individual, whether we can figure out who that individual is, in a way we kind of don't need to. We just know that we need to conquer and we need to realize we're in the middle of this battle. And of course, the great prostitute is called Babylon the Great. Chapter 17 and verse 5, she is called the mother of all prostitutes. Babylon, we mentioned last week, is the idea that it is a realm or all dominions that are controlled by ideas that separate themselves from God. Worldly ideas, as is sometimes expressed in the New Testament. The world. The world usually is a way of describing that which is opposed to God and that which is totally separate and devoid of ideas about God, ideas of worship about God, and ideas that are inherent and clearly aligned with the morality and laws of God. 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17, John describes the world in a very interesting and perhaps general sort of way when he says, "For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh and the desires of the eyes and the pride in possessions is not from the Father, but is from the world." That's a pretty good definition. They separate themselves from God and make all their desires their gods. But in a sense, this is what we're up against. Now, the Apostle Paul in the book of Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 12, I think clarifies that even a little bit more. And as you read through the book of Ephesians, he has rather some interesting things to say. One of the things that Paul keeps doing in the book of Ephesians is to keep telling us that what's going on in the heavenly places. It's a refrain that he'll use three or four times in the book. And he'll say, this is what's happening in the heavenly realms. Sometimes it's a blessing. Sometimes it's what God has done or is doing for us in the heavenly realms. In this case, in chapter 6 and verse 12, he tells us about the battle that's going on in the heavenly realms. He says in verse 12, "We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms." See, our battle is not against other people. It's not against flesh and blood. There's a spiritual battle going on. I want you to look at the words that he uses here. He calls them rulers. He calls them authorities. He calls them cosmic powers, present darkness, spiritual forces of evil. Now, I don't know about you, but I get a distinct sense of foreboding when I hear some of that language. Okay? I get this distinct sense that there's almost like I want to look over my shoulder, almost a paranoia. There's something going on here. There's an evil power at work in the world. A lot of people don't want to recognize that there is evil in the world. Okay? And you see, the whole image in Revelation of a battle seems to fit with the fact that there is a cosmic war going on at the very present time. And as Paul continues his discussion here in the book of Ephesians, the whole notion of his armor, of fitting ourselves with the armor, fits with that whole idea of a battle going on. And the armor that he talks about is the armor of truth, righteousness, the gospel of peace, faith, salvation, and the word of God. Those are all the things that he identifies as pieces of armor. Those are all the things that we fight with. Not the usual kind of battle, but he sort of makes the metaphor of them being like armor that we have to equip ourselves with in order to fight this battle. And above all, Paul talks about prayer. One of the things that keeps coming up in the book of Revelation is that our prayers are like incense rising before God. And I suppose if there's, you know, if nothing else about Revelation, we should remember that our prayers are incense in the nostrils of God. So that every time we do something as maybe as we think as simple as prayer, it's not so simple. It is a powerful instrument of worship. It is something that is mixed in with all the battle things that are going on. Our prayers have a role to play in this battle. And so it's no wonder that Paul will end his discussion of all the armor that we're supposed to take on by saying, don't forget to pray. That's one of the more important pieces of armor that we have. Even though he doesn't label it as a piece of armor, it's something we're supposed to do. And it's powerful because it rises up before God. But as we get back to the book of Revelation and we see all these enemies and these beasts and serpents and prostitutes and so forth and all these things that are going on, we are told that Babylon the Great has fallen. Chapter 18, verse 2. Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Well, that's some good news that certainly the early church needed to hear. My suspicion is it's something that we should remember as well. Babylon has fallen. Now, probably, and again, let's look at the context here in which this is being written. It is more than likely that the church in the first century understood Babylon as being Rome. And I think that's probably accurate. In 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 13, Peter refers to she, meaning the church, the group who is in Babylon. He's probably talking about Rome being the reigning world power at that time. Is the reigning world power Rome at the present day? No. Is Babylon still present? I believe she is. I believe she's still trying to keep from dying. She's been conquered. Revelation chapter 17 describes Babylon here as a woman sitting on seven hills and as who has dominion over the whole earth. That's chapter 17 and verse 18. That's probably a reference to Rome. That's probably a reference to the reigning world power in the day that this was written. But Babylon, the world against God, the world that sets itself up as a culture and a society against God, did not entirely disappear when Rome fell. I believe she's still around. And the record of godless nations proves their inherent evil. I wanted to give you some information today, and I'm not sure how much of this is going to be helpful to you, but it's one of the things that I read a number of years ago was a book by Dinesh D'Souza called What's So Great About Christianity. And he makes a point in there about the fact that throughout hundreds of years of Christian history, people have often criticized the church for the Crusades and the witch hunts and any number of things, the Inquisition, okay, as if somehow Christianity is the evil that has perpetrated itself on the world. Well, Dinesh D'Souza went to the trouble to take a look and compare what they did with what some of the evil nations just in the 20th century have done. Three of them, Russia, Germany, and China. And what things have been perpetrated in the name of atheism and a godless society. Here's what he said. I just think this is extremely significant, especially as you're going out talking to your friends and you hear your friends say, well, what about the Crusades? You know, or what about the Inquisition? Blah, blah, blah. Listen to this. Religion-inspired killing simply cannot compete with the murders perpetrated by atheist regimes. I recognize that population levels were much lower in the past and that it's much easier to kill people today with sophisticated weapons than it was in previous centuries with swords and arrows. Even taking higher population levels into account, atheist violence surpasses religious violence by staggering proportions. Here's a rough calculation. The world's population rose from around 500 million in 1450 AD to 2.5 billion in 1950, a fivefold increase. Taken together, the Crusades, the Inquisition, and the witch burnings killed approximately 200,000 people. Adjusting for the increase in population, that's the equivalent of 1 million deaths today. Even so, these deaths caused by Christian rulers over a 500-year period amount to only 1% of the amount of deaths caused by Stalin, Hitler, and Mao Zedong in the space of a few decades. 1%, and that's adjusted for the increase in the amount of population. What, you know, Stalin killed millions of people just to, I don't even want to go into the details of it, but you know the stories. You know the stories. Mao Zedong in China was probably even worse than that. That's the world. That's what the world does when it dispenses with God. When it throws God out the window and says, God's not important, we're going to build a society according to our own understanding of what society needs to be. The bloodshed perpetrated by these regimes can only be attributed to an ideology utterly devoid of God. The early church, when they heard the notion that Babylon has fallen, they said, wow, thank you. We need to remember that Babylon has still fallen. She keeps coming back. She keeps trying to resurrect herself. And we see it today. People want to keep perpetrating ideas devoid of God and think that somehow, as long as we expunge Jesus Christ in a discussion about Christianity from our discussions politically and socially, then we're going to be okay. Why is there so much anger about Jesus Christ? I think it's because they know Jesus Christ has conquered. And he's going to continue to conquer. Christ has begun to reign in chapter 11, verses 15 through 18. And that's one of the blessings that we see continually brought up in the book of Revelation. Christ has begun to reign. And these are two nations in conflict. Christ's kingdom and the kingdom of the world. Go back and look at Herod's jealousy of the new king, and you'll get a pretty good understanding of just how the world feels about a real king. His grandson's pride and pomp caused his own downfall in Acts chapter 12, verses 21 through 24. And I think we also get a pretty good understanding of how the church felt, or at least the heavenly multitudes feel, in chapter 19, verses 1 through 5, when they read that Babylon has fallen, they are jumping for joy. These evil regimes have done nothing but destroy the world and the people in the world. Kind of interesting, is it not? Chapter 19, the rider on a white horse. You know, you think about the old westerns with the cavalry coming to the rescue. Well, let's change it a little bit. Instead of cavalry, let's call it Calvary to the rescue. Because what you have in chapter 19 is the image of a rider on a white horse followed by people all dressed in white. And this rider on a white horse is given several names. Number one, he is called Faithful and True. And what he does is he judges and makes war in righteousness. He is called the Word of God. And he is clothed. His clothes is a robe dipped in blood. He is also called King of Kings and Lord of Lords, who is followed by the armies of heaven. He's the leader. He's the ruler. He's the rescuer. He's the one who's going to come. And he wears many crowns on his head. And so it's only natural that he's leading the charge. What he does is he judges and he makes war. He makes war against the enemies of God. He leads an army, verse 14. And he strikes down the nations with the sword of his mouth, verse 15. Maybe this is one of the reasons we need to remember, you know, we don't need to allow all the forces of evil to intimidate us into silence. Jesus comes with the word. He comes to slay the nations with the words of his mouth. And we don't need to have evil intent when we do this, but we need to be able to be truthful. We need to be able to be courageous in simply saying, what are the truths of Christianity? Because they are the truths of God. Because God himself is with all of this. Remember what we started it with in chapter 1? All the way back in chapter 1, the one speaking to John says, I am the Alpha and the Omega, who is and who was and is to come, the Almighty. These are his words. This is the message in the narrative that is the message and the narrative of the world in which we live. And so when the rider on the white horse comes and strikes the nations with the words of his mouth, it's because he's bringing truth. It says also in verse 15 that he satisfies the wrath of God. Maybe we cringe a little bit at that because the wrath of God is powerful. The writer in Hebrews says it's a horrible thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And so as God's love is powerful, so is God's wrath. In verses 19 and 20, as we read further on in this section, he captures the beast, the kings, and the false prophet. And in verse 21, he slays the rest. And the church is glad when he captures the beast and the false prophets and the kings. Folks, we live in the midst of a cosmic battle. When we refuse to take part in the ways of the world, don't be surprised that they vilify us for it. Because the ways of the world are dead set against the ways of God. Remember what Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 3 through 5? He says, "The time that is past suffices for doing what the Gentiles do, living in sensuality, passions, drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, and lawless idolatry. With respect to this, they are surprised when you do not join them in the same flood of debauchery, and they malign you. But they will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead." We shouldn't be surprised that the forces of evil kind of get their hackles up whenever we decide we're not going to do that. We think it's wrong to do that. We have to be able to just simply stand firm and say those things with love and gentleness in our hearts and with respect for other people. We may be waging war, but we're waging war with kindness and love. We need to remember that here in the book of Revelation, Babylon has fallen. I think she still fights like a cornered beast, but she indeed is lost. And maybe that's why she fights so fiercely, because she's lost. The rider will be victorious. Don't break ranks. Keep following him. 1 John chapter 5 and verses 4 through 5 is a good reminder. "For everyone who has been born of God overcomes the world. And this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith. Who is it that overcomes the world except the one who believes that Jesus is the Son of God?" Stay behind the rider. You will be victorious. Eric, let's stand and sing.